everybody. Welcome. Ooh, thank you. Welcome to the Retronauts panel live at Midwest Gaming Classic 2024. Apparently, this is the most full panel to date. We have the draw of one American Gladiator. That is our power as a podcast. I apologize to Tower. I respect him. And I'm afraid of him. I'm Bob Mackey. Who is here with me today?
Unfrozen Caveman Esper, Diamond Fight!
And who else is here?
Half Esper about to wig out, Nadia Oxford.
Yes, we're all going to enter trance mode, in my case, extreme anxiety, because the leader of our group, Jeremy, could not make it today. We were on the floating continents, and we had about 30 seconds left, and I was like, oh, he's not going to make it. So now we're in the world of ruin, because we are going to wing it to talk about one of the greatest RPGs of all time, Final Fantasy VI. It turns out a real crowd pleaser. So yes, we're here today to talk about it. By the way, it is not Final Fantasy III. If you refer to it by that name, you will be ejected from this auditorium. I see some guilty parties being pointed out in the audience. We'll take care of you later. But yes, Final Fantasy III released obviously in 1994, making us all feel very old. But it was Square hitting peaks in storytelling and mechanics and music and just so many great hallmark things happening with that game. I guess we can talk about our history with the game to start off with. Let's go with Nadia.
My personal history with Final Fantasy Final Fantasy VI is, of course, I played it on the SNES. I still had the original cartridge. My characters were all named after Power Rangers because it was that time in the 90s. And I've told the story before, so if you listen to my podcast, I'm sorry if you're hearing it again, but are there any Canadians in the house? Yeah, okay. Yeah, congratulations.
If you pay enough money, they let you in.
Well, if anyone remembers in the 90s, like, everybody was selling video games. Like, you could go anywhere and buy a video game. And for some reason, a hardware chain called Canadian Tire was selling Final Fantasy VI after I bought it. And I had most of the money, but my dad had to kind of spot me because with tax and everything, it was like $115. So those cartridges were very, very expensive. And he said, okay, I'll get it for you. I'll get the rest, but you have to give me the Canadian Tire money. Because back then, when you bought something, you would get a little bit back in like Canadian Tire money, which is like funny money, but it was good at the store. So he spent that money to get it for me, and I paid him back. But when he spent the money, the cashier saw the price and said, like, yeah, well, this must be for a very special person. And my dad said, nah. So that's my history. I played it to death. I think it was one of the games I would say that really inspired me to become a writer because Ted Woolsey, a localizer I admire very much, like, he resolved to treat the script as reverently as possible. And he did. Like, he saw this game and said, this is a story for adults. I mean, to be honest, like, the 30th anniversary just went by for Final Fantasy VI, and the only way to think to really pay tribute to it was to say thank you to the first game that treated you like an adult.
And Diamond, what's your history with the game?
Well, it's much shorter than Nadia's because...
I ramble.
No, not on storytelling length. I'm talking about the actual number of time that's passed because I did not play this on Super Nintendo. I played the original Final Fantasy, and then I only played one Final Fantasy on Super Nintendo, and that was Mystic Quest! And many years later, I found out that the other games were actually a little more acclaimed. So I recently, not that long ago, played Final Fantasy IV, aka 2, and I thought that was really great. And so with the anniversary coming up, and more importantly, this podcast coming up, I was like, well, I guess I better finally get around to playing 6, because, I mean, over the years, that game's been available on many different platforms. I've bought it digitally multiple times, including the Pixel Remasters, which I think are really nice, by the way. I'm sure we'll talk about them, but... So I've been playing it just throughout. Even on this vacation, I'm still playing it. And, you know, it's good. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are here. I think it's a good game.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not here to insult it. As for me, I was there on the ground floor as a 12-year-old in 1994. You could speculate on my age after the panel. And, I remember very clearly it cost $72.99, which I could not imagine anything costing more. And I think with inflation, that's probably the cost of a one-bedroom apartment in Milwaukee. Just the deposit, at least. But yes, obsessed with it since then, always drawing Moogles in my notebooks. Could not convince any friends to like the games until Final Fantasy VII came out. But yeah, and I'm recently playing through it again, Pixel Remaster. This is not an advertisement, but just a great way to re-experience the game. So many quality of life improvements, so many bug fixes. But yeah, let's talk about how Final Fantasy changed over the years. So essentially, this was not a rule they were following, but the odd entries were basically the rule book entries of Final Fantasy, and the even entries were the campaign book, meaning that the even entries were more focused on storytelling, the odd entries are more focused on mechanics. That's true up to a point, but it does seem like, I see you have something that Sakaguchi said, Diamond.
Yeah, I found this quote from the 25th anniversary, which is now 5 years ago, so, you know, and he said, quote, "People say that the odd-numbered Final Fantasy games are system-based and the even-numbered ones are story-based, but it's just not determined that way. It's simply a matter of the creators getting tired and not wanting to do things the same way as the last time. So they're just changing the way it's presented." Mm-hmm. That was translated by Brian Clark. Hey, it's Brian Clark. 1 million power, Brian Clark.
Thank you.
It's from his website.
So yes, going over the history of the series up to six, so Final Fantasy III introduced the job system, had a fairly light story, nothing characters. The DS version tried to add some characterization to them, but essentially they're empty shells. Then we have FF4, which created a structured quest with a cast of characters whose fixed classes define them in some ways. So now it's more about exploring the story of, like, what is a summoner, what is a dark knight, etc. So looking for ways to filter story through these mechanics. And then we have 5, which everyone loves, and it upgraded the job system. It's just like a beefed up Final Fantasy 3. But the characters are not too interesting. I'm sorry for all of you Bartz fans. That's what we're calling him now, right?
Yeah, you can't talk shit about Kryle. You can't do that.
Kryle? Okay. She's fine in my book.
Okay.
Yeah. Galuth died so Kryle could live? Is that what happened in that game?
Yes, Galuth died so Kryle may live.
Spoilers, by the
way. Reason for the season.
Yeah. And,
I just know there's a big bridge. There's a big bridge in there.
Mm-hmm. Big bridge, yeah, that's,
That started all the big bridges. And then we have 6, which we're talking about today, which takes all of the roles of FF5, adds some new ones in, and turns all of these classes into a cast of characters with personalities and personal quest lines. So basically beefing up what 4 did. 4 was an extrapolation of what was going on in 1. This is an extrapolation of what was going on in 3 and 5 in terms of the mechanics. Anything else to add about just the growth of the series over these first 6 installments?
I mean, Bob, the way you laid it out like that, it sounds like no one cares about 2?
I like 2. 2 has its problems. I'm not going to play it anytime soon, but it's basically 2 is the larval stage of 4. You have the angsty Dark Knights, you have Dragoons, you have all the good shit that eventually gets built upon in 4. But 2 got hit in the head so that 4 may walk.
Right. Well, it hit self in the head, right? You're supposed to hit yourself in the head to level up, right?
It donated most of its organs to 4. So it's, I've tried multiple times to play 2, the Japanese 2, and I just can't do it. But I know with the Pixel Remaster, again, not an ad, they did make a lot of quality of life improvements. So maybe this time, but I think like maybe 4th time, joke's on me, if I try it again. Creators of the game, we have Hironobu Sakaguchi, is the godfather of the series. At this point, he was promoted to a vice president role at Square, so he had to be less hands-on. And the other creators are Yoshinori Kitase, who is the planner or director of the game, the narrative director as well, and also Hiroyuki Ito, who is the guy behind the battle system, just building off of what came before in the series so far. And then a guy whose name is pretty known to most RPG fans, Tetsuya Nomura, who at this point was drawing monsters, but also created the 2 most emo of the heroes, which are Shadow and Setzer. he would not step into a much bigger role until the next game, obviously, and define the look of FF for a while after that. More people involved. We have Kazuko Shibuya. She made all of the very cute battle sprites and SD characters on the Japanese packaging, and if you play those remasters, she has basically recreated all the sprites to work better with non-CRT displays.
I think she did a great job. I know there's a lot of controversy around the sprites, but those sprites, of course, were made during the days of CRT, where you expected a certain amount to smear. And I understand people now are kind of like angry about preservation and whatnot, but looking at Terra's original 16-bit sprite on a HD TV as it was on the SNES is not quite as attractive as clean and easy to nicely defined as it is in the Pixel Remaster. I think they did a great job.
Yeah, they're really fantastic. And also, I read that she did all her sprite work for those characters like first, and then I guess they called Amano in to like draw like the fancy versions. So if you look at like the variety of art over the years, you can see some discrepancies. Like apparently Amano made everybody blonde, and behind the scenes they're like, look, we can't have an entire cast being blonde. So you got green hair now, lady. Sorry. Which I think is for the better, because honestly, you know, especially if they're all the characters this tall, you really got to have some color in there.
Yeah, upon playing the remaster recently, it made me realize how many of the male characters have ponytails. Now they're all just so accurately depicted. There's no worry about the CRT smear. So she's involved. She's a big part of FF as well. And also Nobuo Uematsu, who is the music guy for FF, arguably at his peak performance with this game, hitting new heights, doing a lot of great things with leitmotifs. Every character has a theme. Variations of it are played throughout the game. Fantastic soundtrack. It really speaks for itself, and it's one of the most popular soundtracks in the FF library.
Kind of remarkable what Uematsu did with the cartridge, because you have the ending song, which does not loop. It is like a 20-minute ending that has the original song on top of Dancing Mad, which is a four-tiered song. It is absolutely insane. And you know a game has good music when you have parents who don't play games, but they are musicians, and they say, well, that game has really good music. Like, if my dad heard a Nintendo game, he's like, well, that sounds like shit. What's wrong with that? But Final Fantasy VI, my parents were pretty impressed, especially with the opera.
Yeah, I think it's one of the few or only Super Nintendo games where there are maybe two 17-minute songs on the soundtrack, the Dancing Mad and the ending. Dancing Mad might be 13 or something. But, yeah. Nobody was writing game music that long.
Not on the cartridge, especially.
Especially for 1994. So we can go over the story. We're going to go over the different elements of the game and talk about why they're so great. So the game begins in the middle of the story. Things have already happened. You don't know who you are. You get this really neat credit scroll over essentially a cutscene from 1994. And, basically, this, along with other Final Fantasies of the day, are very inspired by Star Wars. And because it's taking place in the 90s, you play essentially a group of terrorists, but they're the good guys. And you're out to destroy the Empire. And I see you have a quote here from the sprite designer, Diamond.
Yeah, speaking to what I was raised earlier, so Shibuya talked about how she worked, you know, really hard on all these sprites. And she was just surprised at how the many ways they were used, because, you know, I feel like Final Fantasy VI, even more than the earlier entries, they're really pushing the boundary of what they can do with the characters as is. You know, you've got you know, this central band of, you know, heroes you're working with, and you got a bunch of monsters, and the heroes and the monsters don't really look like they come from the same planet. Which one of the moments I think was really funny to me is when the it's Sabine. I'm sorry, I changed the names when I played Final Fantasy VI, so I'm not on top of the names of everyone. So Sabine is like the martial arts guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a, when you meet him, like, he has to face off against one of his other like disciples or his like fellow student. And on the screen, you've got this giant, like, you know, buff, rippled dude, and he's got a lot of detail in his drawing. And across from him is this little cartoon man with a ponytail, and you have to fight them against one another. It's like, you're related? Are you the same species? Like, what the hell's
he
going on here?
Step on him. Well, no, he can't. Saturn just suplexed him, which I think you could do to him, but you're supposed to use the... I grew up with the original translation, so to me it's called Pummel, but I don't remember what it's called in the retranslation.
But because the game is all built around, you know, manipulating these little characters, Shibuya said that she drew them in all sorts of different animations, like waving and fainting, And since the characters have the same proportions on both the world map and in battle, you could use the animations in any scene. So when she saw the completed cutscenes, she was surprised at the use of the character graphics in ways I didn't think of them to be used in. And one that comes down to me is, I think in one of the jail cells, if you examine the toilet, you just jump on the toilet?
And you use it.
I guess. Yes. I guess that's the implication. So I guess while you're visiting Kefka in jail, you can just take a piss, which is... I mean, you know. Yeah.
It's. I mean, they're the only toilets in the game. You need to use them. You're right, Diamond. The acting had really evolved since Final Fantasy IV and V, because I think all of the acting in those games is a character just putting their head down or raising one hand.
Yeah.
And you had to get every possible emotion out of that. And I think FF5 even had like little emoticon balloons, like an exclamation point or a question mark, but that was it. But here you have a huge degree of emotions per character. I mean, it seems really primitive now, but it was very strange to see that many unique sprites for all the 14 playable characters.
Yeah, actually, I went back to Final Fantasy IV after 6, and I was like, oh, okay, I can definitely see where 6 did a little bit of an upgrade.
So yeah, the game starts off standard, scrappy group of heroes fighting an evil empire, and the big twist is that the bad guys win. And for me, you know, playing this game in 1994, not having the internet, I was stuck on the floating continent dungeon for a very long time. And it wasn't until I returned to it months later that I finished it, thinking that would be the end of the game. And then secretly surprised with another back half of the game, which is something that they did a lot more often back then, I feel, like hiding. Although I must have been a dumb child, because the poster that comes with the game has one side that says World of Balance, one side that says World of Ruin. I don't know what I assumed World of Ruin meant, but I wasn't able to put the pieces together.
You're meant to go to Disneyland. Personally, myself, I actually rented the game before I bought it, and back then, we usually had other people's saves with bad names for the characters, of course, but I remember I was playing the game, The World of Balance, and I was like, oh, this is really cool, I love this, and I think I got stuck at the Esper Cave before I had to get the game back, but I did check someone's save file where they were close to the end of the game. It's like, holy shit, this is a whole new game. What is this? Because the sky was red, the ground was all screwed up. It was just like that, but that spurred me on. I said, I have to find out what happened here. And what did I find out?
Yeah, I was so I was in shock when it happened, because the way the game was building up, I just assumed that this was indeed coming to the end. Like, you know, you're in this all new landmass. You know, there's a lot of really tough monsters. The game is telling you, oh, right up ahead, that's where everybody is. And, you know, you've had a couple twists into that point. You know, it looked like the Emperor was indeed very, very sorry. And, you know, I thought it was a little funny that we had to go to the castle and we had to have dinner with him. And
yes.
We had to walk around, we had to talk to as many soldiers as you can. I was like, okay, isn't this your job, dude? But
I mean, that part of the game became an episode of Frasier, a dinner party.
That was a weird sequence, though, because I actually playing that in the Pixel Remaster lately. It's like, okay, talk to my soldiers, and they all say very sad things. Like, oh, I killed too many people, I won't have a normal life, my family's all dead, what's the point? Like, do you want a peace? Yay!
Right, so you have all this stuff, and then you have the moment, oh, wait, no, this weird clown is actually going to be in charge now. And then it seems like you're building to this finale where it's going to be, you know, the Emperor and the clown, and I guess the clown's probably going to betray him, maybe, but then we'll have to fight the clown. But then it's like, no, it's they just win, and our hero, like, falls asleep for a year and then starts collecting fish. I don't know.
I guess part of the angle of this game was that there was no defined protagonist. I mean, Terra is on the box. But once you start the second half of the game, you basically, after you acquire the necessary people you need to get the airship, you can basically go right to the tower, or you can make a party up of whoever you want. Like, Mog could be the protagonist. Umaro could become the protagonist, although I wouldn't recommend that. But yeah, just that was a very groundbreaking thing for a Japanese RPG that are usually very linear. And that's what the big surprise is in the second half of the game. The first half, very prescribed. Here are your parties for different scenarios. It plays just like FF4 would. And then when the World of Ruin happens, after a certain point, a few hours in, it just says, okay, collect who you want, find whatever you want to find, and then beat the game whenever you feel like it, which feels like a much more Western-style move at that time.
It's also kind of an unapologetic game, because when I played the game, I hadn't been using Celeste at all, and then all of a sudden, like, hey, this is your only character that you have to deal with. I had to actually build her up so she wouldn't die every time she stepped outside. And then it's like, okay, then you can get Savin. Oh, here's Terra. Oh, nope, no Terra. And then you maybe get Edgar, and then you're finally free to kind of go around and find who you want, but it's not like your characters were built up all that much after the apocalypse. We hadn't been using them very much.
Yeah, I thought the game did a lot of clever stuff to make you sort of have to deal with all these people in different ways. Like, when you have that branching point where, like, I think where they're in the falls, and, like, they all get separated, and the game's like, okay, so who do you want to, whose story do you want to follow? And it's not a single choice because, like, whoever you choose, you go back to that one moment. It's like, all right, so two more. And I'm like, oh, gee, they really want me to do all this stuff, you know? Because the first time I did it, I went through and I picked the Sabi storyline, which means I got to, you know, I got to fight the train, and yes, of course, like, I threw the train on the ground, you know, like garbage.
You have to.
And then it's like, okay, two more. I'm like, wait, that was such a long story. How long is this game? And it's like, it's kind of weird that his story is super long. The other two were just like, oh yeah, we're going to the waterfall. Oh, we're done. Yay. And it's like, okay.
Yeah, long story is very short. Not extremely short, but he has that kind of puzzle where you have to beat up people and take their clothes, and I thought that was
hilarious. Oh god. Oh my god, I didn't expect that to be resolved the way it was. I was, you know, you're in that town and like, oh, I'm supposed to be sneaking around, I'm supposed to be sneaky, right? And this one guy keeps fighting me, but I beat him every time because he's a wuss. And I'm like, wait, can I steal his clothes? And I could. And they have a special art of the guy with his boxer shorts.
Like, called birthday suit.
Yes. Yeah, birthday suit.
I mean, yeah, in terms of talking about the contents, it seems pretty tame now, but this was released, I think, before any sort of rating system? Is there?
It was basically right at the edge of any sort of
yeah.
rating system. If you play this game, you will be, one of the reasons I respect Ted Wilson so much is in the 90s, Nintendo was like, you cannot say die, you cannot say dead, you cannot allude to death. And this is a game about a clown destroying the world and killing millions of people, presumably. So he came up with he took the thesaurus and just like bashed the shit out of it. Because like, think about the fact that when your party dies, it just says annihilated. That's okay. Even I feel that's a much harsher word than, oh, you are dead. Annihilated. Okay, whatever, Nintendo, here you go.
Yeah, because when you meet the samurai, and then like 2 minutes later you meet his family and you find out his family, they've all got poisoned by the clown. And yeah, then you're on this, you know, then you're on like the death, the phantom train, the shadow train, and you got ghosts everywhere. So it's like, it's very clearly, you know, they're just covering their tracks a little bit. But yeah, Bob, what you were saying, this was early 94, so the video game violence hearings were like late 93, and I think the ESRB started like at the end of 94.
Yeah.
So like, yeah. Mortal Kombat 2 shows up on Super Nintendo, and it has like a, you know, a marking about violent content. So I don't know when it was April in Japan. I don't know the actual release date in the US. It was, I guess, later in 94.
Something like October, I think.
Yeah. Right.
To myself, like, I noticed the shift between like Final Fantasy IV and Chrono Trigger and then Breath of Fire 2. That was when the ESRB kicked in, or was about to, and they had like nothing censored, like everyone said damn a lot for some reason. There was, your whole mission was to kill God, and that was not something you saw in video games, so Nintendo said, okay, whatever, deal with your own shit, we're done.
Yeah, rest in power, Joe Lieberman. We'll see you at the crossroads, buddy.
See you at the crossroads.
Yeah, I mean, Mortal Kombat was upon us when this game was out, but yeah, this was the darkest shit I had ever seen at 12, where there's an attempted suicide scene. You hear about war and casualties. You watch a genocide unfold on the screen because everyone had just went to the big water drinking party.
there's teen pregnancy, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, there's teen pregnancy, which is barely disguised, if it is at all, I don't think, yeah.
I think they tried to make them married, but it didn't work out. Like, everyone knew you're joking.
Yes, there was no Christian church to marry Dwayne.
They're 16 years old.
Yes.
And the world's ending. Who married them? Duh.
Yeah. Stories of teen pregnancy, stealing clothes from people, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of risque content for the era. Let's talk about the characters. We're going to be recording a separate ranking episode to pit all of these guys against each other later. But basically, every character is assigned a class, and in the US version, this was not evident because their class titles were obscure. They wouldn't be as well known to the American players at this point, but it's more clear in later versions. But yeah, every character has a special class-specific skill unique to them, Every character can eventually gain magic abilities, and every character can attack and use items. And some have magic naturally, you know, if the plot deems it necessary, like Terra and Celeste. So we could talk about all of these and maybe throw out a few comments, because there's 14, which is a nutty number for a 1994 RPG. So we have Terra. She's the poster girl for FF6. She's a half-esper. She can use an ability called Trance to power up her abilities. I believe the more you use it, the longer it will last in the future. Terra thoughts, not Tina. Originally named Tina, where we're Terra backers, aren't we, on this panel?
Yeah, for sure. I'm a Terra person because the way I hear it in Japan, Tina sounds exotic, but I think Ted Wolde made it Terra because that sounds more exotic to people here, whereas in here we think Tina, I don't know, Tina Turner, I don't know, but like, yeah, I think Terra's. And I mean, her hair is green, kind of matches that Earth aesthetic.
Yeah, I called her Minty because of the green hair. I didn't know.
That's cute. I like that.
And she does become a pink naked demon. So we also have Locke, who is the thief of the crew. And it's very odd that you kind of start off with a thief as one of your main characters, but it fits in with these plucky, rough around the edges returners you're playing with. But yeah, obviously he can steal, and he's the only party member that can do that. So he is very useful in terms of getting important items from bosses and enemies and getting elixirs and all those fun things that are usually hard to find.
I thought it was really funny that you meet this character really early, and yeah, he's supposed to be some sort of, you know, he insists he's a treasure hunter, and everyone's like, no, you steal stuff, which I think is really funny. I don't know if they were actually trying to comment on, you know, like how much museums are full of stolen goods from other countries, but in any case, it made me laugh. And it's funny, you sort of meet this guy, and you assume he's going to be some sort of pluckish rogue who, you know, who's traveling around breaking hearts. But you find out, no, he's really upset because he had one girlfriend and then sort of lost her because she had there was a problem there. And then he kind of works into like a love triangle because, you know, he meets Terra and I think they sort of have a thing maybe, but then he meets the other lady later on, like the general, what's Ceres, is it?
Celeste, I'm sorry. Basically, Locke has problems and he projects that onto Terra. This whole thing is like, I'll protect women no matter what. And I don't think his, well, God, I'm not going to start shipping more here, but I don't think his thing with Terra was so much as romantic as that, okay, I got to protect you because you're a girl. Then he met Celeste, and we'll probably go into this later, but I absolutely love the love story behind Celeste and Locke. I find it's very screwed up and adult, which is extremely suitable. And the way it is basically Locke and Celeste are in love, but Celeste cannot handle loving Locke until she's sure that Locke is not going to call her Rachel in bed. That is
the whole. They really have to bury that girl, I think. You can't just leave her lying around like that.
No.
Away, Bob. She fades away like a Jedi.
That's right. Celeste, we talked about her. She's the Rune Knight. She's one of the early characters that can use magic. Very useful. I mean, this is just my personal opinion. I don't really understand the runic ability, and I never figured out a good use for it outside of the one boss fights.
Yeah.
It's necessary.
I've been using runic so much, and I do not understand how it works at all. I do not, like, there's a special guy in the tutorial hut who's like, do you want to know about runic? Like, yes, please tell me. And he, you know, I read it again, I'm like, I don't get it. I still don't get it. But it is useful.
It absorbs all magic, even the good stuff you want to cast.
That's the problem. Yeah. But it's extremely useful in the world of Rune when you're fighting that stupid demon, Humbaba. Because he has some pretty powerful spells, not only with Celeste and Savin, but you can, like, absorb his poison and lightning spells.
So yeah, that's Celeste. We also have Edgar, who I think is OP, but I love Edgar.
He's so OP. Yeah. He's so broken. Oh my god, I love Edgar.
I mean, his tools, he has a vast array of tools you can buy, and they're all basically very powerful spells, essentially, with no MP use.
Once you have Drill, it's just like, you've won the game, because that can go through all defenses.
And Chainsaw. Chainsaw rules, too.
Chainsaw's great, too. Like, and but even if you don't find a Chainsaw, because you have to have a whole puzzle for that, the Drill, like, it costs like 100 gold or something stupid, and it's just like, okay, here I come.
It's funny that, the Edgar, the king of some small territory, is kind of like, he's the skirt chaser I thought the treasure hunter thief guy would be. He's the one, like, every time you meet someone around the castle, they're like, oh, the king flirted with me again today. It's like, okay, yeah. I don't think that seems like a breach of trust if he's the king. He shouldn't be doing that.
Edgar is not surviving Me Too era. They cleaned up his interactions with Realm, I'll say. That's all I'll say. Savin, I believe in the Japanese version, known as like Mesh or Meshu or something like that. Matthew, maybe. So a monk, super, super powerful. Essentially, they were co-opting a little bit of the Street Fighter fandom by letting you control a RPG character by inputting, you know, your standard fireball motions and so on. And thankfully, in the newer versions, it just shows you what to put in. But in the past, you just had a blank entry window, and you just did the motion, and pray to God it worked.
Oh my God, the original didn't tell you what to do?
No. Let me tell you how
I would have been so angry.
Let me tell you how stuck I got in Vargas, because you had to do the pump. I'm like, I don't get this, Mom.
And there was a problem where it's like LRL. Does that mean the L button or the left on the D-pad? So yeah, Sabin rules. Weirdly enough, he's a monk, but he can't do dual attacks from the start. You have to get the Genji glove. So that's one way to make him a little weaker, not overpowered. Now we have Gao. He's a berserker. You basically learn monster skills and perform them in battle. And it takes a lot of work to get Gao up and running and functional in your party. Thankfully, they make it easier now, but he's a guy I normally leave behind outside of the few instances where, like, oh, I taught him the stray cat move, and it's the most powerful thing I can do at this one moment in time.
But you have to find the stray cat. That's the thing. On the belt, you find random groups of enemies. And what I do is, if I get Gao, I'll stick around for, like, 5 minutes, and if I get the Pterodon Rage, which is Fireball, that'll take me through the entire world of balance, practically.
Yeah, I mean, he can use important skills, but once, just like another character, once you set him going, he's kind of trapped on auto battle. So he can't heal, he can't do anything else.
So if you have an enemy that's like, you know, absorbs fire and he's using fire, well, screw you.
Yeah, I actually had to restart so many battles that way. When I set him up, like, okay, we've been fighting people for like an hour in this dungeon. Here's the boss. I'll see Rome with the same attack I've been doing the whole time. It's like, oh no, the boss loves fire. He loves it. And okay, well. Thank God for quick save.
So we have to speed through some of these because we have more stuff to cover. Shadow is a cool ninja with a dog, Interceptor. Shadow will join your party temporarily. You can hire him, and he'll leave on his own free will. But once you get him in the second half of the game, he's with you for life.
Once you find him in the World of Ruin, he's with you for good. But Shadow's a Shadow because it's a very rare instance of Square using very subtle storytelling. Like, Shadow is Clyde Aronay, who is Realm's father, and you can find a lot of hints, including Shadow's dreams, if any of you got the shit skid out of you, like I did. Like, it was 3 a.m., I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to the inn and save, and I'll go to bed, and suddenly, like, this horrible noise comes up, and it's just like this terrible, subtle, like, this guy comes and starts saying really cryptic things to me, which is even more cryptic than the original translation, because it wasn't quite right. So that left an impression. But put everything together, she find out Shadow is Realm's father, and he ditched her, as good fathers do, I suppose.
Super powerful, and especially with the throw ability. He is one of the guys you can just lose forever, though, in what I referenced up front. And they're not very clear about telegraphing that you can lose him.
I missed him the first time around.
Me too.
Because you said you had a terrible time in the dungeon in the Floating Continent, so I'm like, I'm getting the hell out of here. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Yeah, the prompt is not even like, do you want to wait for Shadow? It's just like, leave now, basically. So it's not implying that you're waiting for anyone.
No.
Yeah.
That
so we have Cyan up next, Samurai. One of the big important improvements they made to him with newer versions of the game is his ability before, you had to wait for a meter to slowly build up and then remember what each of the numbers signified.
Yeah.
In our modern world of post-Pixel Remaster, you just select the tech. And it just goes to work, and it's such, it makes him so less tedious to use.
Yeah, and shout out to the retranslation, where you always find a dirty magazine in a Final Fantasy game, it's like a tradition at this point, and of course that wasn't something we did in the original SNES translations. So you found a magazine, you find a magazine that Cyan is hiding in the World of Ruin, and I can't remember the name of it in the original translation, but the new translation is called Bushido in the Bedroom. Brilliant. And if you find it, he's so worked up about it.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't do that kind of pun with Sword Tech, which was the first.
Sword Tech in the sack.
The kids couldn't know about Bushido until that Tom Cruise movie, right?
More like Sword Dick. That's all I got.
We're gonna move on to Mog. Now, I personally love Mog. He was the mascot for the game in the U.S. He's on the cover in an illustration, I think, done by an American artist. But his skill is fairly useless. It does a cool effect where it changes the background. But he's another one of those characters where you set him up, and he basically auto-battles. And he might not do skills you want. And all of the dances he does are based on background environments in the game. It's essentially like a Geomancer and a Berserker at the same time.
Yeah, Yeah, and he can, if you use a dance in an environment that it belongs to, like I think the something Rondo belongs in the underground parts of the game, like the cave parts, like he'll be fine. But if you try to change up the dances, like say do a grassland dance in a rock environment, like there's a 50-50 chance he'll stumble. But if he does get that dance and the environment's not meant for it, he can do some really powerful, especially healing spells. But it takes a lot of work. It's not usually worth the risk. But I just like having Mogs. He's such a cool looking character.
Yeah, he's a cute little mascot.
He's a little mascot. He's a cool boy.
I thought it was so funny that when you find him and you meet him and you get a chance to get, if you examine where he was, you get that charm of his, which basically turns off random encounters. And it's just funny to me that the game had that function built in as sort of like, well, it's late in the game, you might need this. Whereas the Pixar Master, you can just do that at any time.
I don't know. I read this recently, but apparently that was the charm belonging to his dead lover.
I've heard this lore before. I don't know if it was invented by fans, but it does ring a bell for me.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's official or not, but I'm pretty sure it is. But either way, come on.
I mean, the first time you go to that cave, it was like, it's full of Mogs, and then like, there's only one left, so I guess, yeah, must have been...
Yeah, he has one of the saddest backstories because you watch his entire little cute race die out. Or I guess it happens off screen, but still very tragic. And then we have Realm, who was formerly the most dangerous character in the entire game if you played the original American SNES release, because she could just destroy your cartridge if you misused her sketch ability.
She is someone with a very, very high magic stat. I think that's probably owing to her heritage. But yeah, she is a Pictomancer. And something was wrong with the game, and could really screw things up just by using Pictomancy. So she really is the most powerful magic user in the group, because she can screw up your game.
I mean, the little booklets always tell you not to get your cartridge wet, not to introduce any liquids. So it's like you're playing with paint. You know, it's right there in the box.
Hey,
don't do it.
You got a point.
Don't use the painter in your cartridge.
Now you can safely play with Realm, though. Strago, I find him fairly useless. I apologize to all of our Blue Magic fans out there. Yeah. What's that, Nadia?
I don't use him, except in the... Burning House, the name is Aqua Breath, but in the original translation it was Aqua Lung, so I was like, hey, Aqua Lung. So that's the only time I really used him.
Yeah, he has super low stats. The blue magic is useful, but it takes a lot more work to learn those, even more than like getting Gao up to speed. So it's if you really want to put a lot of investment into a character who is kind of weak. And then Setzer is a gambler. He has the slot machine ability. He also, you can equip him with something that that gives him the samurai ability from FF5 where he can throw money.
Yeah, he can throw money. He has guild toss, and also there is a way to screw with his slots, and I don't know it, but yeah. He's also, since he's a gambler, he's also got that move that where you can like kill the party and the enemy party, and I think it's Joker, or Joker Wipe or something like that. It's just, yeah, I don't really use him. In Final Fantasy XIV, though, I gave my chocobo his barding. So I have a chocobo that has like this really nice, long like cloak that's black and it has like gold trimming.
Yeah, getting that Joker or the death slots now is an achievement.
Thankfully, I've never seen it.
It's much easier to restart your game in the new versions. Let's go over the last couple. Umaro is a Yeti, another Berserker. You just wind him up and let him go because there is no controlling this man. He is just a wild animal that, for whatever reason, will join your party in the World of Balance. I think it's because Mog's your buddy and he'll join you.
Yeah, you gotta get Mog, and Mog will get him to join you. And it's actually funny, you can see Umaro in the World of Balance when you go back to Narsha at one point, and you go into like the cave areas, you'll see him kind of pop out and look at you. And I was always like, how do I get that guy? And then you find out, but I got the game, it was around Christmas, so I named him Bumble, because he looks so much like the Rudolph character. Mm. He has a blue face and the white fur.
I call him Shaggy.
That's a good name too.
And then Go-Go, who is actually from FF5, and I guess technically the most powerful player in the game, especially if you know how to use him effectively, but yeah, mime is his ability. And he can repeat ally actions even if it makes no sense to the game. He'll just repeat whatever the last action was. And it could be something as powerful as like casting two Ultima spells or stealing or whatever. It just, he is very useful, but you have to take a little bit of work to dig him up in the game.
Go-Go was a very interesting character in the original translation because since we had no idea what was going on with FF5, they skipped it over completely. There were so many weird fan theories about who Go-Go was and why they were there. And there's this whole thing about how they were Daryl, like Setzer's lost lover. There's also something about them being like a politician, there was a whole thing someone wrote up just for the hell of it about how he's supposed to signify some politician in some faraway country. It was absolutely nuts what we did on there on the internet.
Absolutely. And one of the most busy mono character designs, he's like wrapped in 9 different kinds of quilts. Or they are, yeah. I guess we don't know man or woman, who knows? First non-binary RPG character, maybe?
I'll take the representation. I'll take it.
Yes. I guess we do have to wrap up pretty soon here. So I want all of you on the panel here to call out anything in like 30 seconds, something you want to call out about the game. I do want to call out, it's something in the notes here. One thing I loved as a kid is how easy it is to cheese this game. You can do the Genji glove and I believe the offering relic and basically get 8 attacks physically, and then the gem box and the offering fire off 2 spells with 1 MP each. And that just will let you blast through everything. So the tools are available to break the game if you can find it.
I just, you know, as someone who lives in Japan, I'm very well versed in what a kappa is now. So I think it's really funny that, you know, 30 years ago, obviously, you know, Ted Woolsey, you know, looked at this character and was like, okay, we don't have this thing, but I guess it's an imp, maybe?
Yeah.
And then it has a whole sort of side effect where, you know, you can turn into an imp, you can turn other things into an imp, and there's like imp gear, and it's, you know, to me, you know, in 2024, I'm like, that's not an imp, it's a kappa, what are you talking about? But it's just, it's funny that it has this whole legacy as something else, just because, you know, Ted made a call and, you know, he did what he could.
Actually, in the 90s, there used to be, I think Nintendo Power issued a challenge, like, defeat Kefka with an imp party. And if you got, like, the imp equipment, it could be done very easily. So that's a really neat little side thing. Final Fantasy VI was full of a lot of those. And I really appreciated the escalation of story, most of all, because the Empire is the threat. And then by the time he gets to the World of Ruin, like, it's funny, there's in South Figaro, there's just an old, rusted Magitek armor, and there's a thief there laughing at it, saying, you know, imagine, like, when this was a problem, and now, like, everything's trying to kill us and poison us. Remember the Empire? That was great. Remember Occupation? Woo-wee!
Well, yes, that is all the time we have to talk about FF6. Honestly, we could sit here for many more hours and go on, but I think the people running the show would not like that. But, yeah, thanks to all of you for coming. Of course, we're Retronauts. You can find us online, wherever you find podcasts. And you can support us online by going to patreon.com/retronauts. Lots of bonus shows. We'll be recording another show after this just about the characters and ranking them and locking them in a fierce battle to see who is the best FF6 character. But thank you all for coming. It's a great turnout this year. Thanks again.